Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors, and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.
Hello, welcome to the Citywire Funds Fanatic podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden, and then for my first interview in 2023, I'm welcoming back Marcus Fair Mudge, manager of TR Property Investment Trust. Marcus, good to see you again. How are you? It's a difficult time to be investing in commercial property, I think.
Gavin, good morning, and thank you very much for having me on the program. We had an annus horribilis in 2022. Pan-European real estate equities were the worst performing GIC sector, falling.
When you say GIC, global investment company?
Yes,
I'm guessing.
Yeah. GIC classification. So, property equities versus tech or financials or hardware or whatever.
Because you're the only fund listed on the London Stock Exchange that invests in other real estate investment trusts in the UK and Europe.
Yes, we are. And I know, what I just said sounded like I'm sort of being sort of boisterously optimistic, but I think the point I'm making is that having had a very difficult 2022, we've started to see a real resurgence in share prices that's sort of kicked off in the second sort of first and second week of December and has very much continued. And there's all sorts of good reasons for that.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, but before we get into that, I don't want to look forward and be as positive as possible. But just to recap, it was your half year results in December underlined what a difficult year you just said 2022 was. Asset value dropped about a third. So what was going on? It was all to do with rising interest rates, or was it recession fears as well?
Yeah, essentially it was all about the cost of money. Property is a levered asset class, and investors took fright with the fact that your cost of debt is rising, no different to you're coming off your fixed rate mortgage, and of course that impacts your net income quite severely. I think the bit that a lot of the investment community are really coming to terms with now is the fact that an awful lot of our property companies are themselves quite protected, i.e. they have fixed or capped rather than floating rate debt. And sort of in the middle of 2022, we really dusted off the 2008 playbook, where we look back at focused on the liability side of the balance sheet rather than the assets, because I'm sure we'll come on to it. But the underlying return from the assets has been really, really quite robust. But what the market was very worried about was this rise in the cost of debt. And that is what we focused on. But it's more nuanced than that, because actually you've got to look at where your sources of debt come from. Is your lending from a bank, or have you been accessing the bond market? And remember that we raised through the last decade of QE, property companies and many other companies have been able to raise vast amounts of debt at very, very low cost. And we are very much focused on companies that still have that legacy of long-dated debt, and that's a very important focus.
And so last year was difficult because those borrowing costs went from near zero to 3-4%.
Yes, and if you had a lot of short-dated debt, then that's exactly what happened. But if you had a lot of long-dated fixed debt, then you haven't experienced that collapse in your net income. And I think that's a point that I think a lot of investors have missed. And the sector certainly gathered a bit of momentum on the way down, and then I think investors have begun to realize that it really has been quite oversold.
Yes, so as you say, I mean, there has been a bit of a rebound in the past few months. I think your net asset value is up 12%. The shares are up 18%, I think I saw yesterday. So are we past the worst, and have the property companies fixed their debt, those that need to?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And we probably have to just step back, which is we are in a very unusual market conditions where essentially yields are rising because the cost of money is rising, which means that capital values are falling. Yet at the same time, we're still seeing rents rising because the underlying real estate fundamentals are still strong. In fact, Tritax Big Box announced their results this morning. Second half, 20% drop in capital values, but their rental value actually went up by 9%. So there's a client, and they're obviously own high quality logistics logistics property.
So it's curious. Is it a case then that it's a kind of the sector's been sold off on a top-down basis because of kind of macroeconomic concerns about, you know, interest rates and the impact that has on borrowing costs, rather than, but the actual, the kind of bottom-up view from demand for properties, tenant demand and the rents is all, is more positive?
Absolutely. You're spot on. And of course, therefore, to answer your original question, essentially is what's going, you know, if the thing that's pushing values down is the cost of money, where do we think rates are going? And I think the analogy I would use is 6 months ago, the outlook was extremely foggy. No one really knew. Now the fog has lifted. And to take a skiing analogy, the slope is still looking pretty nasty and it's got a lot of moguls on it. But we haven't got that nasty flat light where you can't actually see where you're going. So essentially, we think when you look at the curve on the 5 and 10 year swaps, you can see some sort of stability. Now, I don't think we are at peak rate. We think the peak rates will occur somewhere in the second half. Obviously, inflation is going to come down. We can look at the cost of gas futures, et cetera, and also the base effect. So we are reasonably confident that the banks will start to lend again. Margins will be wide and things will be difficult. But if you've got the right real estate in the right markets, then I think you're going to find banks and other lenders will be supportive. However, there is still a lot of secondary and tertiary assets or short income property which will suffer. But we've tried very hard to make sure that we're not exposed to those to those, particularly when we come on to brown buildings in offices or something like that.
So there's a lot of uncertainty around, and I suppose that explains why UK real estate investment trusts, REITs, their share prices are still many of their share prices are still quite wide discounts, 20 to 30% discounts below asset value are not uncommon.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, when we look at Europe, pan-Europe, that figure of sort of 27% is about where we are at the moment. Of course, that discount means that when you look at the earnings and the dividend yields of these companies, they really are quite substantial. If you just assume the last full year's dividend for TR Property, based off our current share price, because we're trading ourselves at a 9 discount, our dividend yield is 4.5%. This is, higher than it's
which
been
is high for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been higher. Yeah, and it reflects the fact that so many of our underlying companies, their share prices are trading on these big discounts.
So, but just on these discounts, does that mean the stock market is anticipating further falls in the valuations of the properties they own?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what the stock market is predicting, and it tends to follow until it can see. At least indications of a bottoming in the market. And it tends to be around, the stock market tends to be around 6 months ahead of the physical market. And we know that NAVs are still falling because the valuation community, are always looking backwards. They're trying very hard to be up with current events. And I think the corrections that we've seen in underlying values in 2020, particularly in DEC 22, and particularly in the UK, are indicative of how much quicker the valuation community is getting up with events. But yes, the stock market is predicting further falls. We are predicting potentially further falls in some sectors, but we're also starting to see some stability. And I would highlight that in multi-let industrial and the logistics space as areas where we're starting to see buyer demand. And in the last month or so, last few weeks, there have been a number of deals done, and we're starting to see that open up.
So industrials and warehouses were a really hot area of commercial property till last summer, and then interest rate fears, they got very expensive and the yields were quite low, and so they've suffered as interest rates and government bond yields have gone up.
That's exactly it. In a way, the darlings of the market in sort of 2020, 21 and into 22, where yields had come down dramatically because people were expecting or experiencing strong rental growth, those yields got too low. So I would highlight not only the industrial market and logistics you've highlighted, but also something like German or Nordic residential, where again, you've got a very secure income stream. You're picking up an element of indexation. Rents are sub-market, and yields were driven down, down to sort of 3%. If money's going to cost you 5%, you can't.
And if government bonds are yielding over 3%, then something property, which is riskier than a government bond on the whole, absolutely, it's got to yield more.
And if you look at
the price therefore comes down.
Absolutely. And the correlation between, particularly for these large German residential businesses, and the 10-year Bund is incredibly high. And of course, that's, you know, we need to see that turn for those stocks to become attractive again.
I mean, just going back to these the wide discounts, we're just in the UK, we're just starting to get the kind of fourth quarter NAVs, net asset values from the REITs. Do we need to get another quarter's worth of sort of data, end of first quarter? When do you think we'll have enough information, or investors will have enough information to be more comfortable, to be reassured?
Yeah, I think I think what will happen is you're going to see, you are seeing these dramatic figures reflecting either the last quarter of 22 or the last half, depending on who's reporting. And I think when we get to the end of the first quarter, two things will happen. We will see a slowdown in the pace of fall, for want of a better expression. But more importantly, I think you'll see, more positive statements on trading outlooks, i.e. investors will start to become reassured that the pace of correction, of negative correction, is slowing, or may in some cases have stopped. But really crucially, from where I'm sitting, it's, what's happening to that net income from these companies? Are they able to keep renewing leases? Are they able to make improvements to buildings and let them at new rents? How much tenant failure have we had as we go into what will hopefully be a relatively mild recession?
Right, exactly. So it's the kind of depth of the recession is key. If it's a bad one, then more businesses will go out of business, more tenant failures.
Absolutely. And the evidence going back from the last sort of 30, 40, 50 years is that if a recession is mild, you see almost no tenant failure relative to the overall your overall income group. And quite simply, that's because we can all make less profit in our business, but the last thing we'll give up is actually our premises if we want to maintain being a going concern. If the recession is hard, and we literally, our businesses go to the wall, there's nothing anyone can do about that. But most corporates will make a lot less money before they actually start to give back the premises that they're occupying.
Okay, so we've been talking about borrowing and the fact that the finance problems that some companies have had. So bond markets have been shut, banks are still there, I guess. But in terms of the TR Properties' own borrowing, it's gearing. The fact sheet shows you're geared at 14%. Were at the end of the year. Is that a sign of your sort of confidence? Because that seems quite a highish level. Or does it reflect the asset falls that happened last year and just simply the proportion of debt has gone up?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer is it's really a bit of both. The first point to always remember is that TR Property does have some physical real estate. Today, it's about 7.5%. We own 3 assets, a great industrial estate in Wandsworth, a mixed-use building, which is mostly a Waitrose supermarket in Bayswater, and an industrial estate out in Gloucester, which, by the way, is doing, all these assets are doing well. Waitrose, we actually have indexation on the income as well. And so if you sort of ignore that element, for me to be geared into the equity market, I would need to have at least 7% of gearing. As you say, it's 14, and it reflects the fact that I am optimistic about, given where share prices are today. In terms of our maximum gearing, that's about 20%. And the maximum cash, i.e. my most pessimistic, which was Q3 2008 before Lehman's, we were 20% cash. So if you look at my spread from 20 cash to 20 gearing,
you're much more on the positive side.
Absolutely. I think that's the key point.
Okay. I mean, looking at some of the sectors in a bit more detail, offices, I mean, given the kind of finance problems, borrowing problems you've been highlighting, are there any new developments being built?
It's a great question. And the answer is we will have quite a lot of completions in 23, but then it drops off quite quickly after that. But relative to long-term cycles, one of the great, dare I say it, benefits of the global financial crisis was that the developers found it very hard to borrow money post the GFC. And if you look at the tower blocks built here in London, you look at the walkie-talkie or the Shard or the cheese grater, none of these really involved bank finance. It was mainly global sovereign wealth capital or well-funded property companies like Landsec and British Land. And as a result, actually, when you look collectively, we've got very little development going on at the moment. If you want 100,000 square feet of brand new, high quality, ESG friendly, green buildings, energy efficient in the West End today, you've got a choice of one. I mean, there's very little new space coming on. However, the market is heavily bifurcated between best in class and lots of secondary buildings that require improvement. And one of the consequences of COVID and the working from home is that many employees have a choice. Do they stay at home or do they slog into the office? If they slog into the office, is that a nice working environment? Is that somewhere that they want to be? And companies, that sort of sentiment shift is now running into a general demand by all companies to improve their green credentials. They want efficient buildings. They want buildings which have light and space. And so in some respects, we don't expect a dramatic reduction in the amount of space being occupied in London, for example.
Even though you've said in the past, in the half-year results, that London is a less attractive city to commute to and work in compared to some European cities.
Yeah, absolutely. If you were to take all European cities, who has suffered the most from the working from home? It is London and Paris. And quite simply, the longer your commute, there's a direct relationship, the longer your commute, the less likely you are, or particularly if it's on public transport, the less likely you are to want to come to work. When we look at smaller cities across Europe, so we look at Gothenburg, Stockholm, Milan, Madrid, Berlin, we find an almost 100% return to office. What's so interesting is people want to interact with each other. Yes, they might have a day at work working from home, but what we find in London is we are getting that return. However, the most important thing that's happening in the UK, in London and Paris to an extent, particularly in the CBD, is we are reducing the density of work. So when you and I started work in the 90s, we were really at about 120 square foot per desk, as it were. That got all the way down to 80, partly because we had flat screens rather than big fat sort of TVs, monitors, air conditioning improvements, et cetera, et cetera. We're reversing that now, and we're heading back towards 100 feet per desk. So because you don't want to be all squashed in. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm a screaming bull of London offices. What it means is that I think at the best in class, which are being developed by the likes of Landsec, British Land, Helical Bar, Great Portland, Durham, London, those buildings are going to continue to attract record rents. And we've seen evidence of that. The problem comes in the older assets, because not only do they need money being spent on them, but we've got new energy performance certification requirements, which means that you've got to reach a certain grade of energy efficiency by 2028 and 2030. And if you fall below that, you are not allowed to lease the building to. And so I think that's a big CapEx spend that's sort of barreling down the pipe for the sector as a whole, but not necessarily impacting many listed companies.
I see. Okay, sounds like a catalyst for a lot of activity. Thinking about the sector as a whole, as you were talking there, will we get more mergers and acquisitions? Like last year, we saw LXI and Secure Income join forces. And with the share prices being so low and undervalued at the moment, is that likely to create more mergers like that, or is it difficult for them to be done when the shares are so low?
Yeah, it's a great question. So if we look back at 2020, second half of 2021, and 21, early 22, we had a huge wave of activity. So it fell into two camps. One half was consolidation, and the other was actually take private. So we had a lot of companies today, and one of the reasons that TR Property in the year to March 22, its financial year, beat the market by 900 basis points, was because we had quite a lot of smaller companies that were acquired, many by Blackstone, Brookfield, etc. On the consolidation side, you're absolutely right. The LXI Secure Income merger was a great example of where two very similar businesses owning long-dated income were able to get together. And the thing that stops consolidation is ultimately, invariably, it's down to management and boards, because you start with two chief execs and two CFOs, and you finish with one of each. So you've got four people dancing around two chairs. Now, essentially, you need people to step aside in that process. That's why these mergers are often so hard to do. But they are absolutely the right thing to do, because you do get efficiencies, economies of scale, and most importantly, you increase the liquidity in the shares, which is what everybody, yeah, it's the raison d'etre for being a listed property company that investors.
And it's a broader issue for the investment company sector as a whole, that it'd be better to have fewer, bigger.
Absolutely. And we have a long tail, Gavin, a long tail of small companies. We have, you know, we have dozens of these smaller companies, which the great thing about TR Property as a closed-ended investment trust, we are able to invest in these businesses, help them grow, help them possibly to merge with other businesses as well. So to answer your question, yeah, I'm hopeful that there'll be a wave of investor collective activism to ensure that these companies come together. Now, one thing which is very much a feature of the recent past has been the consolidation in the wealth management communities. You've seen, you know, the Tilneys and the Smith and Williamsons, etc., and you've got these very large wealth. I mean, the growth in a
big wealth, like, managers need big trusts.
Absolutely. And they are all holding lots of legacies of relatively large percentages of these small companies, which really are rounding errors for them. So to the long answer to your short question is I'm hopeful, but we will need boards and chairmen and chairs to understand that the best thing for their company is to amalgamate with another one.
Okay, right. Now, you alluded to TR Properties. It's an investment company. It's closed-end structure. It has a permanent pool of capital. So if people are buying or selling the shares, you know, it doesn't affect you. It might affect the share price, but you've got that same pool of money to invest in. Obviously, there are many property funds that are open-ended and are subject to inflows and outflows, and several have recently suspended trading because they can't sell properties quickly enough for those investors who want to take their money out. So this is not a new problem, obviously, but are sort of distressed sales by open-ended funds weighing on the sector?
We think not really. Quite simply, the open-ended daily dealing property funds, which is clearly an oxymoronic statement because they're not daily dealing when they're suspended. That whole sector has continued to shrink. We had them closing in 2008. We had them again closing in 2016 around the referendum, and then again during COVID. And we really think that the investor community, whilst it desperately wants a product, wants to have access to real estate, is realizing that the best way to do it is through REITs, either buying a basket of REITs or a closed-ended vehicle like mine, or buying individual REITs themselves. So I think in terms of what is left, there are clearly sales going on, but I don't think it's actually a big enough part of the market to weigh that heavily.
Okay. And going back to the subject of index-linked rents, you know, inflation linking is a really important topic, and it's clearly good for investors. But in relation to supermarket income, which we talked about last time, it's a holding of yours. But in reference to it, I saw an analyst note a few months ago referring to the fact that that index linking can lead to over-renting. What does that mean?
Yeah, so essentially, and across Europe, all leases are index linked to a greater or lesser extent. And in the UK, we have something similar, but we tend to have a cap at about 4% and a floor at maybe, you know, 1 or 0 for those businesses that do have that index-linked nature. So essentially, where you get very high inflation, you will find, as you do in Sweden, for example, where you can capture 100% of that indexation, all tenants are experiencing a 10% increase in their rents this year. Now that's troubling, because that's way ahead of market. That means that at the end of the lease, you're going to get a correction if market rents haven't caught up. where we think that inflation is going to return to a more or certainly more palatable than it is now, level of say 3 or 4%, then yeah, you are capturing that in your income. And on the face of it, you are moving, you know, if that is ahead of market rents, then you are, you know, basically building an over-rented situation in your lease. However, these leases are very long. I think supermarkets' average WALT is about 12, a weighted average unexpired lease term WALT is about 12 years. And they will show you, and you can look on their website, look at their presentations, that actually whilst you have that element of over-renting, you are getting that income. So you are compensated on the way. Yes, there may well be a correction at the end of the lease, but also market rents may well have caught up. And you know, particularly in a sector like food, supermarkets, or particularly healthcare, we've got these very long, very strong tenants, be it Sainsbury's, Tesco, the NHS. You know, we're fully confident that the rents will be paid.
So supermarket income is, you know, it's a as you say, it's got long leases. These sort of long dated funds, they were also sold off very heavily on the interest rate concerns. Interest rates going up, the longer your kind of lease, the longer your time horizon is, the more you seem to have been knocked by
absolutely
the fear of rising borrowing costs. But is it the same situation or similar situation to a logistics? The underlying fundamentals are still good.
Absolutely. And in fact, when we think about the way that we receive food when we buy online, it's through a network of the superstores. So you press your click button on Tesco's order, and it will come to your local Tesco the night before, and before it comes out to you in a van. Mm-hmm. Now, but that's only about half of the network. So you want to make sure that you only own those superstores that are actually part of the online network. But it is part of it. Now, therefore, my point being, this is all part of the vital infrastructure for these retailers. These retailers cannot function if they don't have these stores. The same way with the logistics operator. I mean, if you don't, you know, everything is, you heard about Amazon closing stores, three logistics buildings. Those were suboptimal. And they have really focused on their very large RDCs, their regional distribution centers. So, you know, we are very much focused on, as are the companies we're invested in, on making sure that they own the assets which are crucial for the underlying businesses. And that's a really, really important point.
Okay. Speaking of retail, you've built a 16% stake in Edison Property, which invests in retail parks, retail warehouses, out-of-town centers.
Yes, I've actually become an increasing fan of retail warehousing. Essentially, this is the edge of town and out of town, where big boxes where you drive in and you can see, you know, we're talking your B&Qs, your Pets at Home, your Icelands, etc. But we think that going forward, this is going to be a really crucial part of omnichannel retailing.
And omnichannel means?
Meaning as in buying in the stores or buying via the web.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So essentially,
bricks and online.
Yeah, bricks and clicks. Yeah. Because increasingly, it's going to become more and more unacceptable for that van to come down your street 3 or 4 times a day and for you to return, you know, a whole lot of goods. So more and more retailers are going to start to charge you for returns. That's why you'll be encouraged to click and collect. And click and return. Now, you don't want to slog into a very large regional shopping center in order to return goods. You have to pay, you know, park or go to your town center and pay for parking. The great thing about retail warehouse parks, lots of parking, lots of space, very easy. And so we think they're going to become a really fundamental part of that click and collect and click and return culture. At the same time, rents are low. Relative to shopping centres, and very importantly, you've got almost no service charge. Remember, in your covered shopping mall, it's got to be lit, it's got to be heated, it's got to be cooled. Someone's got to pay for the, you know, you've got to pay your service charge to cover your loos, security, merchandise, marketing, etc. Whereas in these retail parks, you have, you know, your rent is your rent, you pay your rates. There's virtually no service charge.
Okay, and while we're talking about kind of more specialist property funds, I know you probably don't hold them, but the social housing real estate investment trusts have been making all the wrong headlines recently. Home REITs in particular, shares currently suspended after the results were delayed because of allegations by a short seller. But it follows, you know, a difficult time for Civitas Social Housing and Triple Point Social Housing, which do slightly different thing to Home, but they're kind of grouped together, aren't they?
They are, and I'm often asked by investors why I've never owned these companies.
Did you see these problems coming?
What we saw was a concern ultimately with who the covenants were. We could see on the face of it, these long leases for these properties for real estate that has a really strong social function and is absolutely required by.
When you say covenants, you're talking about the tenants?
Yeah, sorry, the tenant, the quality of the underlying tenants, the operators essentially of these homes, and we just felt that often the funding source just wasn't strong enough. Now, as it turned out, on top of that, there's clearly been an issue on valuation of these assets as they were acquired by the REIT. And many questions about corporate governance on top of that. So, you know, we looked at it very much on a problem at the fundamental level, but of course it's transpired that there's been, many other issues on top of that. Now, that's very disappointing for investors in those companies. But when we look at, it's helpful for the industry to be able to see how important governance is. And at TR Property Investment Trust, we're very, very strong on governance, and I have a lot of engagement with companies. To be honest, we're a big fish in a small pond. We own material holdings in lots and lots of companies, and we engage not only with management but also with boards on everything from remuneration, audit, ESG profiling, etc. So, we're very careful to make sure that we avoid companies, unfortunately, such as HomeREIT.
Do you think there was an element of investors sort of, knowing that these funds were sort of doing a social good, providing homeless shelters in the case of Home, that they were in their rush to support something like that and tick an ESG box, perhaps, that they weren't doing all the diligence they could have done?
I'm afraid, Gavin, that's almost certainly the case. Absolutely. And we are, it was Home were able to raise capital at least a couple of times after IPO. I think absolutely it was tapping into a current zeitgeist. And it just reminds us all that absolutely we want to support businesses that have a social good. But underneath it all, you must first and foremost be sure that the businesses are sound.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sounder investments are the UK, perhaps, are the UK generalist real estate investment trusts, which you've got two at least in your portfolio. There's CT Property, which is at Columbia Threadneedle, which is where you work nowadays. There's been a few acquisitions along the way, but you are now a part of the Columbia Threadneedle Group, and you hold CT Property and another trust called Picton Property Income. So I call these generalists. They're investing in all the different property subsectors rather than specializing in one.
Yes.
What's so attractive about them?
Yes. I mean, I for many years, I've been running TR Property since 2011, and I've actually been involved in the trust since 1997. So I've just gone through 25 years. We've generally, over that period, always focused on specialized businesses. But there is a moment in the sun always for a diversified play, particularly as you see, the most popular sectors seeing pricing adjustments, etc. Sometimes it's worth moving to a diversified portfolio. What I like about these businesses essentially is that particularly in the case of Picton, very, very sound management, very, very careful use of leverage. Chief exec has been longstanding, done a very, very good job, and I'm very encouraged by that. In the case of CT Property, I wasn't allowed to buy effectively funds that were managed by the same management house until a couple of years ago. There's strict Chinese walls. I treat the management of CTPT exactly like any other company. We sit physically in a different building. There is no conflict there. And I just felt that we've got to know the portfolio well. This trust is trading on a 30 discount. It has very low leverage. It made an excellent sale of a large prime asset in Berkeley Street in the West End of London, and is very much set fair. But I do feel that it is one of those many little companies out there that would very much benefit from being part of a bigger business. So we'll wait and see. But I think these diversified names, it's really been about valuation rather than necessarily me feeling that I want to focus on diversified. That's just, it's just a moment in time where they look very, very good value.
The assets are good and they're trading on a very cheap share price. Okay. Well, last question, sort of broaden out a bit. Good, go to the level of quick look at politics, because the mini budget back in September, damaged the UK's credibility, financial credibility, and it caused this big sell-off in government bonds that then, you know, impacted the real estate investment trust sector. So I'm just wondering, you know, have Chancellor Jeremy Hunt and Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, have they repaired some of that damage, do you think? And have you got any hopes for the budget in March?
Yeah, well, so I think the first point to make is absolutely, we want a technocrat in charge, and that is what we've got, and that's great. And we've certainly seen, you know, the markets taking a lot of comfort from that, and increasing stability in gilt rates, etc. I think it's important to remind listeners that TR Props is a fully pan-European vehicle. We actually, in terms of actual assets, we have more than 50% of our assets.
It's true. We haven't talked about Europe all that much, but
across Europe than the UK. It doesn't mean that the UK isn't very important. I'm actually long the UK relative to the benchmark, so I'm clearly positive about this. Do I think that the budget, what can we hope for? I think that one of the key points, which we've already seen, is the change in business rates. And the moving, speeding up of transitional relief. So that's helping, subsectors like retail, where rents have fallen so fast, and push a bit more of the burden back onto those parts of the property world where rents have risen very quickly. So logistics, warehousing, et cetera. So there is a bit of rebalancing. All that we can really hope for from a real estate perspective, in the budget is a bit more stability. And further leveling up, you know, would help. Although I hasten to add that we find it quite hard to get access to regional property, beyond outside of logistics, and multi-let industrial. And we're not that keen to own offices in regional centres, partly because rents are so much lower per foot. And when you have to spend a lot of money, it costs the same to put new air conditioning and new double glazing, etc., in your building, whether it's in whether it's in Berkeley Square, Boreham Wood, or
pick
Bradford.
Looking for a bit, casting around for bees there.
Yeah, terrible. Yes, too early in the morning.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Marcus, thanks very much. That's very interesting. That's all we've got time for. But yeah, no, thanks for showing us that perhaps. Yeah, all is not as bad in commercial property as last year's performance might have suggested, that if the recession isn't too bad, perhaps the sector will be pulling through in due course. We shall see. But thanks very much.
Thank you, Gavin.
Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.